All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 76 in this American History Program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. Today we're going to get into a new topic, namely the Industrial Revolution. But I'm going to give you guys one last chance to submit a map of the world as it would be in the present day if the Civil War had not happened. And I'm going to give you a preview of my map before we get into this topic. So here we go. Here's a preview of my map of the world. It's not totally finished. As it would be today if the Civil War had not happened. Wow. Looks interesting, exciting, and different. And very different, yes, very, very different than it does today. So, if you guys want to make your map, then you are welcome to do so. We can compare our versions of the world today if the Civil War had not happened. Woo, exciting. All right, but I'm only going to tell you what it all means tomorrow if you help me to make some fun maps of your own to compare. Okay. So, anyway, let's get into our topic of the day. Swap displays and all that sort of stuff. And take you to the Industrial Revolution. Okay, so, the first key thing is, of course, with regard to this period in history, is to examine to kind of define terms, right? And to examine and to have in our minds the proper context for what it is that we are going to see by having a good definition in mind so that we can anticipate this content as we reach it. And it's built right into this term, the Industrial Revolution. The concepts that are involved that historians have used to describe the change that we are going to witness here, it's embedded right inside the term. So, to get a preliminary understanding of what we're going to talk about, all we need to do is parse this expression, Industrial Revolution. And if we can do that, we're already going to be quite a ways into understanding what it is that we're going to see. So, in this two-part expression, we have industrial and we have revolution. Okay, so, let's start with, in our analysis of the term itself, let's start with the term revolution. And then we'll look more, because we've seen that one before. And then we'll look at the more, I suppose, more complex term there. In a way, the specific term that has to do with this one, the Industrial Revolution. So let's start with revolution. We have seen revolutions already. We didn't really talk about the fact that they were revolutions, but now is no better time to do that. So what revolution have we seen so far in our story? And so we're going to be able to, which we'll be able to pair up with Industrial Revolution in order to understand the term revolution. So, what revolution have we seen? In which Americans declared their independence. Sophie, please. American Revolution. Okay, good. So we've seen one already. Why is it a revolution? So that's the key here in our situation. Why is it called a revolution? And so it is thoughts first from your end. Why is it a revolution? Any idea? For instance, just to lead you here, why is it not called merely the American Colonial Rebellion? Or perhaps the American Revolt. Why do historians use the term American Revolution? Why not resort to or simply use these other terms, rebellion or revolt? I mean, was there an element of rebellion? Wasn't there a rebellion? Was there a rebellion, Cliff?
Yes.
Tell me about it.
Well, the Americans rebelled against the English.
Okay. Rebelled against... A rebellion is what?
It's an uprising against the common rulers.
Okay, good. Well, that's a pretty decent definition. A violent uprising against the government. Okay, a rebellion or a revolt. Those are pretty synonymous terms. Did we have revolts previously in... Here, I'll share my screen with you guys once again. There had been revolts previously against the English king in history. In particular, where? Cliff, go ahead.
Magna Carta.
Magna Carta. Okay, that was the end result of a revolt. Just going to turn off the noise. I forgot to do that earlier. Okay, so yeah, that was a revolt. So, but why isn't this a revolution back here? This is what I want you guys to think about. What's the difference between a rebellion and a revolution? A revolt and a revolution. Why do the events leading up to the Magna Carta, they're just known as the Baron's Revolt or Baron's Rebellion? Why not a revolution? And the American events, on the other hand, these guys over here, what they're doing is a revolution. What's the difference? It has to do with the size, the nature of the change. What kind of change did this produce, the Magna Carta? Before it and after it, what kind of government did England have? Micah.
A monarchy.
Monarchy. Before it and after it. So what was the change?
Constitutional monarchy.
Okay, good. So the Baron's Revolt of 1215 made a modification to the monarchy. What about this? What did it produce? Was that just a modification to the monarchy? 1776, declared independence. A government should be dedicated to the protection of individual rights. What kind of government do we have on the other end of this? Declan? It's a name for a government dedicated to individual rights.
Sorry, I'm blanking.
Well, there aren't very many choices. We got some precedents back here. It's not majority rule. Something else. Timothy.
Wait, sorry, I didn't fully understand the question. Can you repeat it?
What's the name of a government dedicated to individual rights?
Republic?
A republic. Okay. So, we have a government, we have a change here in 1776 from monarchy to republic. So, in the one case, we have a revolt, we have a rebellion. The barons rebel, they say, alright, we don't like the way the king's doing things. We're going to make him sign a document. But afterwards, there's still a king. There's still a monarchy, and there's still going to be an argument between barons and kings for hundreds and hundreds of years. So how much of a change has there been? Not much. Not much. I mean, it's progress. It is good. But it's got a modification to the way things have always been done, and they continue to be done that way. There's still a king, but there's been a change. On the other hand, in the American Revolution, there is a radical change to the way the government works. There's a radical change to the whole premise of what government is for one thing. The concept of monarchy is not designed to protect people's rights. There's no concept of rights in monarchy. The only one who's got rights in monarchy is the king. He's got the divine right to rule, which is a perverse concept, but anyway, that's the way it works. And so, to go from a monarchy to a republic is a huge change. It's radical. How many times in history do we have anything even remotely similar? In the 5,000 years leading up to the American Declaration of Independence, this is why we have our anchor fact timeline, right? How often do we have anything like this? Barely a couple interesting exceptions back here. They didn't last, and they were gone, and they had disappeared thousands of years before. And so for the Americans to do what they did to create a republic was just an incredible change. It was a huge transformation, and that's what we need in order to have a revolution. We've got to have a huge, historically significant change. The whole nature of history has to change before and after. History is one way before the revolution. History is a different way. Life for human beings, in some sense, has to be different when you've got a revolution. That's the kind of change that it is. So we have a term for that. Now, but there's, what if the change towards a republic happened over many, many hundreds of years? Let's say it was still going on today. Americans were still arguing with the king. They had secured a little bit more, a new kind of modern Magna Carta in 2015. And it went on for another couple hundred years until finally at the end, well, after many hundreds of years of constitutional monarchy in America and so on, okay, finally the argument drags on and Americans say, all right, we're going to be independent. And, okay, no more king. So what if it takes 1,000 years to get it done? At that point, do we have a revolution? At that point, are historians talking about the American Revolution? Why or why not? Cliff, is it still a revolution if it takes 1,000 years?
No, not really.
Why not?
Because revolution can take a long time, but it's not exactly a revolution if it's really a gradual thing. I don't know really exactly how to word it, but
okay, the difference is that now you said revolution can take a long time. What do you mean by that long time?
I don't think it could go as long as 1,000 years, but it could take a few hundred years, a few generations, but I do not believe that it could take 1,000 years now.
Okay, right. I mean, it depends what kind of change, but it's got to be a change that happens relatively fast. Otherwise, we're not going to use the term revolution, right? What's our term for a change that's gradual? Very similar to revolution, but a change that's gradual involves small changes accumulating over time. We have this theory in science, of course, having to do with small changes over time. Life on Earth, what do we call that theory? Whether you agree with it or not, Cliff?
Evolution.
Evolution, okay, right. So we have revolution, we have evolution. Very similar terms. It's just one letter difference, but there's a huge difference in terms of the meaning. Because a revolution is something that happens fast. Now, it's fast is a relative term, right? So as we're going to talk about today, doing certain things at a certain speed, fast is relative. So that we're going to have to understand. So it's going to be a change that has to occur fast, but relative to how things were before. That's the key to the concept of revolution. So we have two ingredients in our concept of revolution by itself. We have, it's got to be a huge change, a historically significant change, and it's got to be fast. It has to occur within a relatively short span of time. Otherwise, well, it's an evolution. It's a gradual change from the way things were at one point to a new way of them being. All right, so those are the two components. Now, in our American Revolution, we have that. Right? We have a huge change. We have a change from monarchy to republic. We have the repudiation of monarchy. Like, that is a huge change. And it happens quite rapidly. I mean, say from the Stamp Act to the Declaration, that's just 11 years. As opposed to 5,000 years worth of monarchy, that's really fast. Right? So it's a really big change in a really rapid amount of time. So that's the American Revolution. Does anybody know any other political revolutions that we can maybe combine? You don't have to know the details of them, but have you heard of other political revolutions that might be useful to kind of combine in your thinking with the American Revolution when you're thinking of revolutions? Other famous revolutions in history? Well, you're going to have to stick around for European history in a few years' time. Study your French Revolution. Study your Russian Revolution. Those were definitely two of the other most important transformations in terms of governments. Both of them also, all three of those, the French, the American, and the Russian Revolutions, all three of them rejected monarchy. But the thing that's interesting about them is what they substituted. So that's the rest of it is part of European history. But so if you don't know those, all right, you can't use them in conjunction with your understanding of the American Revolution if you're going to understand what a revolution is. So luckily for you, you'll at least have the Industrial Revolution to ally with the American one in terms of your understanding of the term. So you probably don't know about the Scientific Revolution or the Copernican Revolution or other wonderful revolutions in history yet. So perhaps you'll have a chance to learn about them and understand their significance. But let's talk about the industrial one. So in other words, having to do a revolution having to do with industry. So what's your anticipation? If it has to do with industry, what does it have to do with? When we think of industry today, what do you think of? Sophie, what's industry?
Industry is the large scale, large scale production, I would say.
Okay, those are really big abstractions you're trying to use there. I don't think we have to go. I mean, I understand why you're trying to say that, because you're trying to think of modern industry as this domain of human activity. But it's simpler than that. Just think about cottage industries. Think about just industry on a small scale. What is it? You used a really good word, production. We'll come back to that. But what is industry? What would be, let's say we describe a person as industrious. What are we saying about him? What does that mean, Piper, to say that somebody is industrious?
Like heavy,
as in large?
No, as in like hardworking, like.
There we go. Okay. I'm not sure why that's heavy. You think that people who work hard are heavy, like psychologically kind of hard to deal with? Is that it?
No, I don't know. It was just the first word that came to my mind.
Okay, but hardworking, right, okay. So somebody hardworking. All right, industrious. So industry means work. Somebody is industrious is somebody that does a lot of work. That works hard. So that's what industry is, and work. And then, now Sophie used another word which is very closely related, which is a good word to use. And it has to do with what is work. So we're digging a little bit here, down layers of our and down into the depths of our concept here, the layers underneath the definition. So, you know, when you look up a word in the dictionary and you get a definition, usually that definition involves other complicated words. So if you really want to understand the definition, you're going to have to dig beneath the words that you find in that definition, find their definition, think about what they mean, and keep going until you get ideas that are relatively accessible. So the Industrial Revolution is a rapid, important historical change that occurs in the realm of industry, which means in the realm of work. Okay, what do we mean by that? Work. What's that? It's work. Nowadays, what's kind of a common way of thinking of work, Sophie? If somebody works, what do?
They either physically or mentally do a task.
Okay. Yeah, Sophie's got a very philosophical mind, likes to work with abstractions. Physically or mentally do a task. Okay, so, yeah, I mean, all right, so doing a job, right? Working means having a job. Okay, which means doing some kind of activity for what purpose? As opposed to, there's a lot of different activities we can undertake. As opposed to play or recreation in particular. Declan, why do people work?
Sorry, what was the question?
Why do people work?
To make money. To buy food.
Okay, all right. So now we got a few different interesting layers there. Yeah, today people work typically to make money, but money is not the end of work, right? Money is a tool for being able to purchase the things that you need in life. So if we take away that intermediary, people work in order to get the things they need in order to live. All right, so now we're getting somewhere here. And the things that we need to live are what? What are those? Sure, you've heard of these, the cardinal values. I think they're something like in the pyramid of values or something like that. I don't know what they are, but anyway, people nowadays encounter them in different contexts. What are the things you absolutely need in order to live? Liv, give me one of them.
Food.
Okay. What else? What's another one?
Shelter.
Okay. Food, shelter, what else? Declan, what else needs to be on that list?
Which list?
Of things that you absolutely need in order to live.
Food, water.
Alright, water would be an addition. So now we have food, water, shelter. Is our list complete? If we have that, we have everything that we need. If we're going out of the shelter, we might like to have something else, Micah.
Clothing.
Okay, right. If you got a shelter, you could probably get away with running around naked a little bit. But your shelter is not going to be complete. I mean, you still have to go out into the world to get the food and the water. So you better be clothed, unless you happen to live in an absolutely idyllic setting where it's neither too hot nor too cold. So yeah, you're going to need clothing. And typically people add to this list, they say medicine as well. Which makes sense, because evidently, I mean, people can sometimes get away without ever having any medicine in their world, but people live a lot longer and more successful lives if they have medicine as well. And then you could talk about psychological needs as well, but that's kind of a different category. So in other words, the social needs like friendship and love and so on are really critical to our existence as human beings, but just on a purely physical level, these are the things we need. We need food and water, absolutely. And we need clothing, we need shelter, we need medicine. All right, so these are our cardinal physical values. Now, Sophie earlier used a word, which is a really good word, which is production. So why did you use that word, Sophie? What does production have to do with all these values that we need?
Usually, in this day and age, you can't find these things, or most people don't get these things without producing them or making them or doing something in the interim to get these things.
Okay. Now, you're suggesting that it's only in modern times that this condition arises. But the truth of the matter is, I mean, in ancient times, there was no medicine, so human beings had to produce it. They had to develop that ability and go from having a life that typically would last about 30 years to one that lasts 80. So medicine has been produced. But even things like water and food need to be produced. Otherwise, if you're relying on whatever you can find in nature, I mean, all right, you can pluck an apple off of a tree. There's only so much of that you can do. You don't find any civilizations in the world without agriculture. So agriculture is the production of food, learning how to plant crops, irrigate, water them, harvest them, store the food products, and so on. So you don't get food without production. You don't get civilizations without the ability to produce food. And all the water that we have, there's only so many mountain springs in the world. Not everybody can live in a mountain spring. Even in pre-industrial times, never mind today. I mean, still people do kind of the same thing today. If you don't live next to a mountain spring, how can you get water? You still have to produce it. In what sense? Let's say right now, like in so many modern movies, there's a technology apocalypse and there's no more water flowing in your pipes. How are you going to get water? What are you going to do? We're turning ourselves into preppers here. What are you going to do? How are you going to get water? How are you going to produce it? How are you going to survive, Timothy?
You would have to either make a hand pump in your backyard, or you would have to get a big bucket and go to the nearest fresh water stream and fill up the bucket and then walk back home with a big bucket of water. And then you'd have to keep on doing that to survive.
All right, talk about work. To find a stream and bring the bucket back to yourself and fresh water source, which means it's got to be way high up in the mountain. And so talk about work. Talk about industry. The need to survive just by your sheer horrible physical labor. I mean, alternatively, and some of the time, you could capture rainwater if you know how. So that's going to be relatively clean. Timothy says a hand pump. I don't know where that comes from, right? But what did people in medieval times do? Which, of course, required work, but How did people get water even in a place where there wasn't a stream going by or they weren't close enough to have a source of water? What do you do then? What do people do on a farm? Anybody know? I can tell nobody here is going to survive the apocalypse. Sophie, go ahead.
You dig a well?
Yes, there we go. Okay, Sophie at least is going to be on her way. You got to dig a well. The water, the ground will filter out the water. A lot of water sources that are subterranean are also clean because they get filtered through the earth, basically, which is a fantastic filter. Okay, so, but in order to get it, you got to dig. You're going to dig by hand, or you better learn how to make some tools and so on. And you got to find a way to bring the water up from down below, so you better invent pulleys. And you got a lot of work to do to get access to these things, even in primitive times. So it's not modernity, Sophie, that creates the need to work to produce these things. We have to work. Our luck nowadays is that whatever work that we do, we can usually transform that into nice handy pieces of paper, and we take those pieces of paper to somebody at the store that's done the work to produce the other stuff that we need, and we exchange it. So they'll take the money and we take home the products, and that's very nice. So, but all of this requires work. Not any of it is out there in nature in a way that human beings could possibly survive. So there is no society on earth where there's some kind of, like in the Bible, a Garden of Eden where everything is just provided and it's wonderful life of ease that requires no work. You just pluck the fruit off the tree and the water is running by in the stream and it's clean. And so that's not the world. The world is a place where human beings have to enact certain causes to get the outcomes. They have to work in order to live. Plain and simple, human beings must work to live. There's no way around it. So the Industrial Revolution then is a time in history involving a huge historically significant change in the way that people do this. A huge transformation in the way that people work in order to support human life. Before the Industrial Revolution, as Timothy said, you want to get water, you put a bucket on your head, you walk up the mountain, and you come back, and it takes you all day just to get a bucket. Post-industrial revolution, you turn the tap. That's a rather significant difference. Pre-industrial revolution, you want to eat a steak, Piper? What do you got to do to get a steak?
Got to get it from someone else, sir.
No, no, no. Pre-industrial revolution, what do you have to do?
Kill something.
Yeah, you gotta go and hunt in the forest. Exactly. You gotta go kill that deer yourself. You gotta cut it. You gotta butcher it. And then you gotta make a fire if you know how. And so on and so forth. So just having a steak is quite a big job. Post-industrial revolution, if you want a ribeye, you just go to your local grocery store, plunk down the cash, and take it home and grill it on your gas stove. So, no problem. All right, so this is what we're talking about. How did we go from people running around in the forest, hunting animals and taking buckets to go get water, and all that kind of stuff? And now we get, okay, if you want a nice meal, you simply prepare it and people will deliver the food to you. You go get it at the store and you turn on the tap. You got the water to boil whatever you need to boil or fry. The gas comes to your house through pipes or the electricity comes through wires. And all of that's just happening. And the kind of work that you need to do to have a meal today is entirely different than the kind of work that you needed in the past in order to have the food and the water to survive and anything else, right? In terms of shelter. Nowadays, in the post-industrial revolution age, right, we're living in structures that have Mostly, the foundations, at least, if not all the floors, are made out of concrete. They have wonderful windows so we can see outside and enjoy it. They have air conditioning. That's our industrialized shelter. Pre-industrial? Well, you were lucky if you were in a wooden house, or if you had lots of slaves, you could build a stone castle. or earlier than that, you'd be in a cave or in a teepee. All right, so how did we go from that to that? How did we go from one kind of shelter to another? How did we go from one kind of food production to another? How did we go from these, from having no medicine, basically, to having medicine? And living lives that were short, nasty, brutish, and short, as one person put it, to living the life that we need live now, which is just unbelievably easy. We're all extremely pampered and hardly even realize it. So, we're nowadays our biggest problem is if our Wi-Fi stops working. So, now, what is our life? How did we get to this point is the question. And the answer is the Industrial Revolution. Because Thomas Jefferson didn't have that. And the people of the Mayflower didn't have that. And the barons of the Magna Carta didn't have that. And Menes and Armour didn't have that. So this transformation that we are going to witness is one that happened since that time and which started to rapidly unfold just as American history was getting underway, and it went through a variety of stages. So briefly for today, what we're going to look at is one of those changes. We're going to look at this change right here. And it has to do with how human beings make clothes. So of our five cardinal values that we talked about, food, water, clothing, shelter, medicine, we're going to look at clothes today. Because that was the first change, the first transformation, the first revolution. Here we've got 3000 BC, some kind of a drawing of an Egyptian person engaged in a certain activity. Here we've got 500 BC, some kind of ancient Greek person doing the same sort of thing. Here we've got 1700 BC, some kind of European woman doing exactly the same thing. 5,000 years worth of pretty much everybody's doing the same thing. Does anybody know what they're doing? They're making clothes, as it turns out, but what part of that activity? You guys, I don't know how much you know about how your clothes get made. How they end up on your back, other than the fact that you go to JCPenney and get them. Where does clothing come from? Nobody knows what these guys are doing. Micah says sewing. You're absolutely right, Micah. But what do you need in order to sew?
The wool or the cotton.
Okay, true enough. And so we start, if we go back here, we've got men working with sheep. And what are they doing? With the blade here, they are shaving, shearing, as we call it, taking the wool off the sheep, or gathering the cotton from the fields, as the slaves did in the South before the Civil War. So they're doing all the heavy manual labor to get the raw material. And then, no, they're not killing the sheep. They are shearing them. And they want the sheep to grow the hair, to grow the wool back and do it all over again. So they're not killing them. So they are shearing them, and then you get this hunk of cloth, but it's like it pretty much after you've cleaned it a little bit, and it's not that different from what it was like on the animal. And that's not clothing. I mean, unless you are literally using the skin of an animal, right, as people did in prehistorical times, to cover yourself with the fur of a tiger or a bear or something. Okay, but if you're going to make your clothing rather than just use an animal skin, so you're taking this cloth, either cotton or wool, and it's this mess of stuff. And you put it on a little staff, and you start to do something. Before you can do any sewing, you've got to do something with that particular raw material. And here they, all these ladies are doing exactly the same thing. And Micah says untangling it, which is pretty much what you do. But because of the nature of both cotton and wool, you can untangle it in a very specific way. So you get this bunch of stuff, and this lady is untangling it. This is the best picture. This is the best picture because she is untangling it. But notice kind of what she's doing with her two hands. She's teasing out and twisting and forming up a thread. In order to be able to make clothing, you need thread. That's where it all starts. Once you've got the raw material, you've got a clump of it, you need to get the thread. You need to tease it out and get a thread. And this activity is called spinning. Because you could arrange it, and all of these ladies are spinning in some regard, because this is like a top, and it's spinning in midair. This lady has her distaff, as it's called, in her hand, and she is pulling the thread out from it. This lady has the staff on a little mount, which is nice and useful, and it turns, and she's able to pull the thread out of the clump and make the thread. So, this is called spinning. And for thousands of years, people did it exactly the same way. 3000 BC, 500 BC, 1700 AD, doing it exactly the same way. And then all of a sudden, somebody invents a machine. You put the thread into a frame of equipment. You connect it up to other, I don't know how all these parts work, it's beyond me exactly. But you make a machine, and all of a sudden a woman is standing there in front of the machine. She's moving these parts, and before you know it, using this device, human beings are able to make 200 threads at the same time. One thread at a time. 200 threads at a time. In an industrial factory, 4,000 threads at the same time. One person making 4,000 times as much of the same thing as one person used to be able to do before. An advance of 4,000 times in productivity. That's a fairly large change. Pick something that you love. Pick something that matters a lot to you. And imagine being able to do 4,000 times worth of it more than you can do now. I mean, in this case, we're talking about making clothes. So, something that people need, right? But they're making that many more clothes. So now, what is it like if you want to get clothes? Well, how many people does it take to make clothes nowadays? Right? I mean, how many people do you know that actually work on making clothes? Almost nobody. Because it's made in factories with machines where the thread is spinned like this. And then other machines where there are what are called power looms that weave the thread and produce the clothing, so that the outcome is you don't have to make any. All you have to do is, you know, your parents have to make money, and you go to the store, and well, Department store? I don't know. T-shirt might cost you $10 if it's on sale. So this is radical. I mean, now we have basically as much clothing as we need, right? Human beings today get upset if they don't have a walk-in closet. In other words, we have so much clothes that we need a separate room for our clothes in our house. And before the Industrial Revolution, people had the clothes on their back. If you weren't the king, that was it. That was your outfit. The clothes on your back. Post-Industrial Revolution, you need a walk-in closet. And if you want more, you're going to have more. If that's important to you. So now we have a completely different life in terms of how we make clothes. This was now already ongoing. Just as the American Revolution was getting underway, this revolution in textiles, as it's called, was also getting underway. A British inventor named James Hargreaves created this device called the spinning jenny. And another inventor called Edmund Cartwright invented this device, which is called the power loom. And these devices were, as you can see, lined up in factories. And people labored now to produce these goods on a whole new scale than ever before. To finish for today with just a question. How were these things powered? Ladies were using this equipment. We're not talking about muscle here. You don't see any horses or oxen moving this stuff around. What kind of power do you need in order to be able to produce 4,000 times, to be able to move these machines? Timothy?
Was it coal / fossil fuels?
Okay, yes, partly, which is used for the purpose of generating heat, which boils water and makes...
energy?
Yeah, well, when water boils, what's that called? Brain block. Okay. Sophie?
Steam.
Okay. Anybody ever heard of the steam engine? So tomorrow we'll talk about the ability to produce power in the form of an engine. And then use that power to move all of these machines to a degree that just was never possible before. Life is going to be radically transformed. What does that have to do with how we get to this world around us now? We live definitely in the outcome. In some ways, we're still living through this Industrial Revolution, the new phases of it, especially in communication, transportation. So for tomorrow, we'll get into how did that all begin, and we'll try to make a connection to American history as well. Alrighty, that'll do it for today. Thanks, everybody. If you got a map of the world for me by tomorrow, I'll try to include it in class. We can talk about your versions. Otherwise, I'll just show you what I think the world would look like without the Civil War. And then we'll get back into this topic. Bye for now.
Bye.